Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 5th of October 2020. This podcast is the second in the series which addresses the question, what is fascism? In the first episode, I identified 11 prominent features of fascism by examining historically occurring fascism, namely the cases of Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany. In this episode, I propose to go through most of those features and see if they might be present in the politics and the culture of modern day America, the USA, and the UK. The feature which pertains to the economy will get its own episode, and it'll come after this one. The first feature then. The first feature we identified was totalitarianism. Now, both Italy and Germany became totalitarian states through a process. It didn't happen overnight. There was political shenanigans and manipulations and intimidation and so forth, until eventually in both cases the leader, Mussolini in Italy's case, Hitler in Germany's case, became all-powerful. Now, the current situation in the UK and the US is that they are not one-party states. Both Italy and Germany did become one-party states. And rival parties were outlawed in the parliament. And eventually democracy was disempowered. So we haven't got there yet. Now, are there any signs in the US or the UK that such a thing could happen? That the little bits of democracy that these countries have could actually be eliminated, and that we could have all-powerful leaders. We could have a Führer or a Neil Duce. Now, there have been fairly alarming signs on both sides of the Atlantic that the executive has attempted to increase its power, and of course that power would land in the hands of the president or the prime minister. In both countries, of course, there have been emergency powers granted because of the COVID pandemic. In the US, that power is not concentrated because the states have power. In the UK, Parliament did pass an act giving the Prime Minister emergency powers, or the Minister's emergency powers. And actually, an act existed already for that to happen, Public Health Act of 2008, I believe. And I think some of the powers that the Secretary of State has exerted came from that earlier act. So there is stuff in place for the UK government to start acting with not so much reference to Parliament and to exert executive power in so-called emergency situations. We noticed that Hitler, of course, gained emergency powers. And was able to use them to take executive power to himself and eventually to get rid of the parliament, the Reichstag. In the case of the US, it does seem as though Trump would like to delay the forthcoming presidential election, or maybe have it declared null and void if he appears to lose. And what he's been doing is claiming that postal votes will be frauded. And a part of this manoeuvre has been to try and disempower the US Postal Service. And he's already been shouting about this. I mean, in the debate that he had with Biden about a week ago, he did say, oh, well, it's fraud, it's a fraud. And of course, how can you say the election's a fraud? It hasn't happened yet. The FBI doesn't think there's very much chance of any serious fraud. Historically, postal votes haven't been abused in the US, and the electoral system has been, at least as far as the ballots are concerned, has been fairly immune to tampering. It's not to say there hasn't been intimidation. Historically, there's been a lot of intimidation and a lot of effort to keep voters at home, particularly black voters. Interestingly, there was a leak of the database that Cambridge Analytica used at the time of the 2016 election for president in the US. To Channel 4, who did quite an in-depth news item on that, and it's pretty well unequivocally demonstrated by that database. That there was a lot of discouragement of voters who weren't going to vote for Trump. Particularly, this falls disproportionately on black voters. And there was a manipulation through social media and so forth to attempt to discourage voters from going out to the polls. And as I said, this fell disproportionately on black voters. There's a very good YouTube video of the actual Channel 4 report, and I'll see if I can put a link in the write-up so you can follow that through. In this vein, we should also note that a Cambridge Analytica project has come to light, and that project was to recruit people with mental health problems and drug addiction problems into the evangelical and Roman Catholic churches. Now, this was financed by a charity which in turn appears to have got its money from the Koch brothers. So there was a manipulation of vulnerable people, an identification of them, and then a manipulation of them in order to, first of all, gain tithes and donations for churches, but also to produce a cohort of people inculcated with far-right politics. So there's some kind of dodgy stuff going on there. The whole kind of propaganda scenario that applied in Italy and in Germany. There's immense propaganda efforts to produce these one-party states. And we're seeing similar, certainly in the US. And obviously there are differences, and of course a big difference is the sophistication of the propaganda these days. I think, you know, Goebbels was a pretty sophisticated propagandist, but things have moved on, and of course we've got the internet and social media and digital surveillance and all the rest of it. And so it's possibly more dangerous now and certainly more sophisticated. So all that's going on. Trump is also making a lot of noise about civil unrest in American cities, and Black Lives Matter demos and similar left-inclined demonstrations have been taking place in many, many American cities. The objective truth about these demos is that they are largely peaceful, as far as the left is concerned, but there have been far-right disruptions of those demonstrations, including, of course, in shootings. And the view of the FBI is that the far right, the white supremacist far right in the US, is the biggest danger to the US domestic peace in terms of terrorism, and that Antifa isn't an organisation. Trump's trying to make out that Antifa is this very violent and tightly organised terrorist outfit. In fact, he wants Antifa as classified as a terrorist outfit. And as we know, Nigel Farage is echoing these sentiments on this side of the Atlantic. The objective truth is otherwise. But the furore is enabling Trump, first of all, to send federal police or maybe mercenaries into these cities. And they've been known to kidnap demonstrators. And they're not wearing insignia, they're not identifiable. It's pretty nasty stuff. It's at least possible that Trump wants this unrest to be exaggerated and for it to alarm the American public. In small town America out in the West, there have been rumours going around that Antifa are going to bring a busload of people into the town and burn all the businesses and burn everybody's house down. And so some citizens have been taking up arms and doing roadblocks and informal vigilante checks. Of course, these are all rumours. And it does seem like there is a project in some quarters of creating alarm amongst the American public, such that Trump can claim that there is insurrection and he needs to invoke the Insurrection Act. Now, the Insurrection Act is an act that was laid down in the 19th century. It's been on the American statute a long time, but it does give draconian powers to the president. Of course, this would mean he could suspend the election or something of that type. And it does seem that his behaviour is aiming at some kind of situation in which he can't lose, that he'll get another term, whatever happens, either by crying fraud and getting the election tipped that way in his favour, and maybe getting the election result to go to the Supreme Court, which he's busy trying to load up with a right-wing majority of Supreme Court judges. So all this is going on, and I mean, if you do, without getting too conspiratorial, it does look as though there is an agenda of Trump getting another term and another term and another term, perhaps, through one of these means. Either he cries fraud or he invokes the Insurrection Act by exaggerating the unrest in American cities and by blaming the unrest in American cities on the on the left and on anti-racist and generally progressive protesters. So this does bear an uncanny resemblance to some of the stuff that went down in Germany in the 1930s. Obviously, you know, we'll see when we see what the result of these events turn out to be. People sometimes doubt, in the case of the UK, that the Tory government is authoritarian any more than any other government. Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister and leader of the Tory party, he does this affable thing and tries to be one of the people and doesn't really, I don't know, have the wherewithal to do a Mussolini or a or a Hitler. He kind of fancies doing a Churchill, being inspirational and ostensibly decent and this kind of thing. But it is a surface. There is a strong authoritarian trait in the Tory party. I think a good example of that, going back a little while, is the attempt to prorogue Parliament at the end of the last Parliament so that the Brexit discussions could go on and the Brexit manipulations could go on without the scrutiny of Parliament. A case was taken against the government, firstly in the Scottish court, and I think the lower Scottish court threw it out. I mean, there was a claim that the government had acted illegally by proroguing Parliament so long. And the lower Scottish court sort of found against that and said, well, it wasn't a matter for the courts, it was a political matter and therefore not a matter for a judicial review. But the higher Scottish court found the contrary and threw out the verdict of the lower court and said the government had acted illegally. Since there was this dual verdicts, the UK Supreme Court took it up and found on the 28th of August 2019 that the government had acted illegally, prorogued Parliament too early or for too long, and had therefore advised the Queen wrongly, and Parliament had to reconvene. But you can see there was this attempt to exert some executive power or to take these proceedings around Brexit purely into matters of executive power. And I think that kind of revealed the true nature of the Tory government and the Tory party. Another feature of totalitarianism is the cult of the leader. Now, Trump definitely tries to foster this and to succeed to some extent. Currently, Trump is in hospital with COVID-19, which incidentally he declared a hoax when the virus first started to spread around the world. And outside the hospital, there are quite a large band of Trump cultists all shouting, "We love Trump! We love Trump! We love Trump!" So he's kind of getting there somewhat with his cult of the leader. Having said that, yeah, there's a lot of American people can't stand the bloke and think that he's an absolute disaster for the country. Johnson, it's a bit less so. There is a small Johnson cult, I think, and the gammons like him, and they say, you know, Boris is doing a great job. And there's this thing of whereby he's known as Boris. You know, Jeremy Corbyn was called Corbyn, or even Jeremy Corbyn's fans would call him like Jeremy Corbyn. I don't know what people call Keir Starmer, but Johnson is Boris, he's cuddly little Boris. So there is a bit of a cult, but it's not the kind of veneration that Hitler certainly managed to garner. Almost religious veneration that Hitler attracted to himself from some parties. Now, the feature of totalitarianism is this massive respect for hierarchy. It's the Führer principle, the leader principle, that the leader is at the top, autocratic, all-powerful, devolves, or hands down some power to the next layer, to his inner circle, and it works its way down through ranks and hierarchies into society, and that's the way the power works. And both the US and the UK are countries in which that process is certainly present. Of course, in the UK, we've got a monarchy, and a lot of the old feudal notions of rank and deference are surprisingly still alive. At the same time as there is a large egalitarianism in the UK, particularly amongst young people, a feeling for equality and coming off it vis-a-vis rank and class. So there's kind of an ambivalence because these two things are existing side by side. Similarly in America, America prides itself on being this egalitarian society where you can rise up but by your own efforts and your own talents And they say that anybody can become president. Of course, in the UK, not everybody can become queen or king. But it's a bit of baloney, really. There is an American aristocracy, you know, which a celebrity. Hollywood, of course, provides Hollywood royalty. And there are dynastic families. The Kennedys, for instance, were a dynastic family. And it seems that Trump would like his family to become a dynastic family, in as much as he involves his children in politics. At the beginning of this discourse, I said, well, there's a fundamental difference between Nazi Germany and fascist Italy and the current UK and USA, in as much as the latter two are not one-party states. There is an objection to this, and I think it's quite a strong one, in that there is nothing between the parties. And this applies more to the US than to the UK, but the UK is not completely innocent in this respect, is that the parties rely on corporate donor money. And in the US, certainly, politics has been bought by big money, by big oil, by big weapons, by big pharma, and so on. You can see that there is little between the parties when you consider the fate of Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders, who tried to take the ostensibly left-wing parties and give them a strong democratic socialist component. And both were vilified, and both were eventually stymied by the corporate establishment in their own parties. In the case of Corbyn, there's the leaked document from the Labour Party shows how party apparatchiks and the right wing of the parliamentary party just actively conspired to undermine Corbyn's leadership, even though he was elected twice. And they basically threw the election so Corbyn wouldn't get power. Similarly, Sanders, you know, he played a blinder of a campaign. He created a grassroots, but Biden's the candidate for the Democrats. So there isn't that much between the parties. Maybe the ostensibly left-wing ones, the Labour Party and the Democratic Party in the US, are perhaps going to offer a few more crumbs from the table to the 99%, to the working class. But that's about it. Neither is seriously going to challenge the oligarchical control of the world economy by big capital. In the case of Corbyn, there were rumblings by military top brass and by security service top brass and retired top brass in the UK, saying that, well, if Corbyn gains power, we'll do something about it. They were threatening in a not very covert way a coup. And even more remarkably, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State in the US and an ex-CIA head, said, well, Corbyn's really dangerous, we've got to stop him. And if it does get that far, we will certainly stop him. If it does go so far that Corbyn wins power, we'll stop him. But maybe we should be trying to stop him even now, prior to the fact. This is the American Secretary of State threatening regime change in the UK should Jeremy Corbyn get in. So democracy is really a facade in these countries. We have very little of it. In the case of the US, the Electoral College system, which was set up at the time of independence, basically to defend the slave states, to defend their right to own slaves, really makes the point. Whatever you think of Hillary Clinton, she did win the popular vote by 3 million votes, and you'd think if there was any kind of basic justice that she would have won the election. But the Electoral College system gave the victory to Trump. Similarly, the UK, I keep saying this, we have an unelected head of state and an unelected second chamber with a smaller hereditary component and in which bishops are appointed to the second state, house of parliament. And in neither country is there any appreciable amount of, or any significant amount of workplace democracy. So democracy is a bit of a facade. Perhaps the people have a little bit of power there, but it's not decisive. As Chris Hedges said of the US system, he said, well, this is a system in which I cannot vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. And the same is true of the UK. So we've got a facade of democracy. So that's the first feature. The second feature of fascism is the willingness to use political violence. We could go into all kinds of detail here, but I think I'm going to just give an example. I'm going to talk about Trump and the Proud Boys. You'll recall that in the recent debate between the presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that was televised on American TV, that the presenter asked Trump, would he denounce white supremacism? And Trump didn't denounce white supremacism, but deflected and asked the presenter, you know, give me an example of what you're talking about, because I don't know what this is. Just give me an example. And the guy, the presenter, gave the example of the Proud Boys. Now, the Proud Boys are pretty well the brown shirts. They're a bunch of white supremacists with plenty of links in with other far-right groups that espouse white supremacism and behave like a street gang, and I believe they're armed too. And Trump said, oh, well, Proud Boys, stand down and stand by. Then at this point, Trump started to raise alarm about Antifa. Biden replies that Antifa is a movement and not actually a organisation. And then the discussion continues. Subsequently, there's a furore in the media and on social media, huge furore, saying that Trump has basically given a wink to the Proud Boys to stand by and to be violent if necessary, if Antifa is perhaps demonstrating outside polling stations or attempting to enable black people to get safely to the polling stations and so forth. So this has been regarded very widely as a nod from Trump to this right-wing gang, a violent gang. Amazing parallels to what happened in Germany. There was a lot of intimidation. The political parties had militias, and the SA, Sturmabteilung, performed this kind of function of rent a violent mob for the Nazis. Now, interestingly, the Proud Boys, minutes after Trump had made this statement, changed their logo, and they've got some kind of quasi-military-looking logo, and they've put the words at the top, stand down, and underneath, stand by. Stand by in case there's any trouble from the left. Stand by in case blacks try to vote. Of course, you can read this in many ways. I mean, Trump subsequently denies even knowing who they were. So we can have all kinds of arguments about the semiology going on here, but it's pretty clear, I think, that this was a kind of a wink or a dog whistle, you might say. In the UK, a different culture. We don't have the gun fetish, the weird sexualised death gun fetish that pervades America. And of course, in America, the Constitution does allow for the bearing of arms, the right to bear arms, Second Amendment, which goes back to the colonial days. And which goes back to the time of the War of Independence. But the UK far right does like a scrap. And there is a culture of violence amongst the far right. So we should say that the far right is numerically not enormous. But its ideas have a bit of a wider currency. And the Tory party does occasionally dog whistle to the far right, or perhaps more than occasionally, particularly over racism, immigration, and so forth. And a number of far right people joined the Tory party when Johnson won the leadership election. The police are certainly capable of violence in the UK. I mean, the big example is the miners' strike of 1984-85. If you want a good example of state violence, it's going back a bit. And in fact, like army personnel were employed to fight the miners. And again, as in the case with Trump's goons, they didn't wear any insignia, they couldn't be identified. And political violence is not unknown in the UK. The MP Joe Cox, the Labour MP Joe Cox, was assassinated in 2016 in the street by a far-right crazy. The next feature is economic and cultural crisis as a condition for the rise of the right. Well, yes, and in neither case has there been a real recovery from 2008, despite the stock market appearing to boom. There is actually a good reason why these bubbles have been created. It's to do with the minting of money in quantitative easing, both sides of the Atlantic, which has been used, rather than being used to start new businesses and to develop the productive capacity of the economy, has been used instead to buy back shares and inflate stock prices. As capitalism morphs, particularly in Silicon Valley, away from profits and dividends towards making your money, your fortune, out of stock prices by buying and selling your stock and doing your best to increase the price of the stock or to maximise the price of the stock. On top of that, we've got dodgy unemployment figures. Trump can say, oh, employment's looking good, you know, we've got plenty of people are getting jobs, the unemployment's quite low. But that way of reckoning figures fails to take account of the fact that a lot of people just become economically inactive and they're not counted. The same has happened in the UK as well. On top of that, yeah, there is resentment in post-industrial cities and areas in the Rust Belt and the post-industrial Midlands and north of the UK, which swung to the right. This creates powerlessness and resentment. And I will say this again and again, when you have gross inequalities of wealth, you also have gross inequalities of power, which comes down at the grassroots to people feeling powerless over their lives. 20, 30 years ago, young people in their 20s could get married and get a mortgage at a reasonable and affordable rate and buy a home to raise their children in. That doesn't happen anymore. There is rented accommodation, and it's not cheap. In London, it's incredibly expensive. So this kind of powerlessness at that nitty-gritty level is to do with the gross inequalities of wealth and power. And this gives rise to political violence. And right-wing parties are prepared to exploit the resentment and turn it in their favour through the application of propaganda. And as I said, modern propaganda is pretty damn powerful now that we've got data manipulation, the mechanics of which are coming to light. And my guess is that we're going to find eventually that the 2019 election in the UK was determined quite largely by data manipulation. And of course, the disruption of the pandemic and the way people are getting fed up of the restrictions and the way people are rightly being suspicious of the acquisition of executive power in the wake of the pandemic is adding to this dangerous situation. It's adding to the resentment and it's adding to the economic and cultural crisis. The fourth feature of fascism is that it's undemocratic and anti-democratic. And this goes along with the embrace of hierarchy and authoritarianism and the strongman notion. And we saw that Hitler became both the Chancellor and the President in 1934 and consolidated all state power to himself. And sat, therefore, at the peak of a hierarchy as the Führer. But notice that this process of Hitler's rise came about through the manipulation of democracy, through dirty tricks, admittedly, but within the democratic situation. You can see both Johnson and Trump attempting to actually work within the rules, but to manipulate them in their favour, to find the gaps in the rules, to find the opportunities in the rules and the Constitution and the rest of it, to accrue more and more power to themselves. You don't necessarily need a putsch or a coup. It can happen in this sort of piecemeal way, this gradual way. And democracy is under fire. The little bit that we do have, as I think we demonstrated when we talked about totalitarianism. And when democracy is under fire, I think you have got incipient fascism. Another point about the anti-democratic nature of fascism. Do we have anything else in our situation that could make us smell a ratty? And I would say, yes, there is. The power of unelected advisers. It seems that Dominic Cummings has quite an extraordinary amount of power in the Cabinet Office. I think some of Trump's advisers, similar. So I think there is cause for alarm on that front. The fifth feature that I identified is that fascism embraces notions of racial and cultural superiority. The UK, with its long history of imperialism, embodied this notion during the imperialist epoch. The British imperialists excused their behaviour, their imperialist behaviour of conquest and rule over vast parts of the planet as a part of the white man's burden to civilise the world, to teach the heathens Christianity, because missionaries were sent out to perform part of this task of civilising the savages in Africa and the heathens in India and so forth. And though the British Empire fizzled in the 20th century, particularly after World War II, some of its cultural effects still linger on, as we saw with the furore over the Land of Hope and Glory at the proms and the other jingoistic anthem. What was it? Rule Britannia. Britannia rules the waves. And it lingers on. There's a nostalgia for it. There's even a belief in some quarters that it somehow still applies, that the UK is still this vastly superior country with a vastly superior culture, at least the white part of it. And the far right in the UK embrace all this nonsense. But certainly the UK at least once thought that the job of white Englishmen was to civilise the world. Similarly, the US today has a doctrine of manifest destiny. Or if you like, USA World Police, if you've ever seen that puppet film, which is really very funny. So there's a self-image in the US and also a doctrine espoused by government that the US has a manifest destiny to lead the world. And of course, the president of the US is sometimes called the leader of the free world. And it's certainly true that what happens in this forthcoming election in next month will affect the rest of the world in quite a large measure. Because the US is built on white supremacism and slavery. And when slavery was removed, segregation. There were miscegenation laws in many American states, which were only really fully repealed by in 1967. In 1967, 16 states still had miscegenation laws, which made it illegal for black people and white people to marry or even to have sexual relations by mutual consent. These were repealed finally in 67 by the Supreme Court. This stuff is deeply, deeply embedded in American culture and the American psyche. And this is the point that Black Lives Matter make, that we can congratulate ourselves that we've made progress. But nevertheless, there are still some dark corners in the psyche of white supremacism. And there's some kind of interesting twists in this, because you might think that the neoliberal version of capitalism might be a bit less interested in racism and segregation. But strangely, Buchanan, James Buchanan, a very influential but probably less well-known than Friedman and Hayek neoliberal economist, really adopted an anti-segregation stance on libertarian grounds. Because as a libertarian, he didn't think that rich people ought to be pressured from below by people in masses, in mobs, you might say, protesting or petitioning the government to remove segregation from public schools, to demand civil rights, or to behave in any way whatsoever. So his idea of libertarianism was actually like freedom of the capitalist class to invest their money in any manner which they like without any constraint. You would think that neoliberalism, because it's anti-mass society, might be seen as anti-fascist. Because after all, fascism mobilises mass society. But the contrary is true. It ends up being racist because freedom is freedom for capital. It isn't any other kind of freedom. It's the freedom for capital to invest in any manner it likes, where and when it likes, without government interference. So it can still tend towards the fash, despite apparently being against mass society. I should make a point here that Hitler was inspired by US segregation laws. Saw it as a paradigm that he could utilise. In the UK, we've got the likes of Nigel Farage trying to mobilise racism and xenophobia. Whatever he protests, by making a fuss about small-scale immigration across the channel in small boats and turning this into an emergency, which it clearly isn't. So there's a mobilisation of xenophobia, which has been going on in British politics, rumbling on for decades and decades, sometimes intensifying, sometimes receding. But it's there. And it's in the collective psyche, if you want to put it that way, deeply ingrained as a legacy and a remnant of the days when the sun never set on the British Empire. The next feature is nationalism. Well, it's on the rise pretty well everywhere in the capitalist world. In Trump, it manifests as isolationism and xenophobia. Remember all the talk about Mexicans? And we'll build a wall to keep them out and they will pay for it. And that played very well to a certain base and enabled him to mobilise a certain base. In Britain, of course, we've had all this crap with Brexit and patriotism. And patriotism actually is like a cudgel with which to beat the left because of its internationalism. It's therefore anti-patriotic. And then you get the Labour Party rather pathetically saying that there's a sort of progressive patriotism My own opinion of that is it's complete, absolute bollocks. And they'll pay for it probably in some measure at some point. So patriotism becomes about a cudgel with which to beat the left and get the left to sort of jump when you whistle. But also as a stroke, the country can stroke itself through arousing patriotic fervour. It can tell itself that it's great. It can make itself feel better momentarily, when actually it feels crap because the economy and the culture are actually disintegrating. The next feature is social conformism and social conservatism. I did have these two separate in the previous podcast, but this time I'm just going to bring them together. And both the US and the UK are very diverse societies, ethnically diverse, linguistically diverse. But there is strong popular opposition to the desirability of this. And you can hear it said, you know, the country's not the same. I want to hear English spoken on the streets. And you get this in the US and in the UK, where people will shout at somebody on the street speaking Spanish in the US, because Spanish is very widely spoken in the US by US citizens, bona fide US citizens. And the US is a melting pot. Even though there are parts which are rather uniform. There are great melting pot cities like New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles, in which people of very, very many ethnic and linguistic and cultural origins live and work together and mix and so forth. So there is, as I say, a popular opposition to multiculturalism and to the diversity of the society, which, you know, plays into racism and anti-immigrant sentiments. These are just observable features, well known, of both the US and the UK. The political parties send mixed messages. They claim to celebrate diversity. Johnson does this, talks about London being a great diversity and the great contribution of immigrants to our health service. At the same time, he's dog whistling the right and coming up with horrible, cruel ideas for the treatment of refugees and asylum seekers. Stick them on a boat in the Channel, stick them on an island in the South Atlantic. Which is pure dog whistle stuff to this right-wing base that opposes and is discombobulated by the diversity of our society and by multiculturalism. There's an irony in amongst all this that the ruling class, the 0.001% that control most of the world's wealth and therefore are very powerful, are internationalists and cosmopolitan. They have houses in many countries, they're private islands and so forth. And they don't live in any one country. And of course they do mix and do business together, even though they can be quite ethnically diverse and from having different national origins. There is a phenomenon which you talked about, that there's this kind of diffused global country called Richistan, which is where the rich people live. Of course, if they travel from their villa on their private island in the Caribbean to their penthouse in New York, they go in a private jet. They don't have to sit on an aeroplane with the proletariat. It's possible for these people to stay within a completely private sphere, only inhabited by the rich and some flunkies, pretty well constantly. And that's Richistan. There is a very interesting paradox there. The next feature is the use of propaganda. Well, the use of propaganda is rife. If you were privy to the BBC's radio coverage of the run-up to the 2017 general election and the 2019 general election, and the way the Labour Party was treated, and the Labour Party leader and his allies were treated and falsely accused of anti-Semitism, and being Czech spies and every kind of damn nonsense, relentlessly, by the BBC, which has formerly enjoyed a reputation for being a news outlet of record, respected for its truth and privacy. Well, it just behaved as a propaganda outfit against this possibility of a mildly socialist regime coming to power in the UK. And as I mentioned earlier, this was opposed by the establishment and even from across the Atlantic. There was sabre-rattling. Should Corbyn and Corbyn's Labour get into power? Of course, we've mentioned the digital dirty tricks. Social media and Cambridge Analytica have played their part, and similar data manipulation companies have played their part. They're currently doing their tricks in the US in the run-up to the November presidential election. And the whole thing really is a manifestation at some, if you're going to look for the metaphysical level of all this, of post-truth, of a complete undermining of truth. And I intend to look very closely, perhaps at the philosophical level, to the whole matter of truth in an in-depth series on both epistemology, on truth, on knowledge, on hermeneutics, and on propaganda. And that's, I've been working on that for quite a long time. I've got loads of notes and pre-talks, you might say, for that. So look forward to that, because I think that right at the root of this, not perhaps in any kind of like a truly fundamental way, but as a component in what's going on now, is an undermining of certain necessary concepts of truth and knowledge that have been eroded in popular discourse. The other use of propaganda, of course, is what I call censorship through noise. And that manifests as conspiracy theories like QAnon, which we've talked about in previous podcasts. If you go back, you can kind of have a look at our view on how all that stuff works. I mean, putting it briefly, there is a conspiracy to mount conspiracy theories, which are completely unfounded, in order to create censorship through noise and to divide and rule people. We saw the demonstrations in Trafalgar Square on a number of successive weekends against masks, against social distancing, against the idea that COVID is anything but a hoax, against science, against reason, which nevertheless is fueled by a real intimation that draconian executive powers held by the government are in fact dangerous. That bit they got right, the rest they get wrong. So there we are, divide and rule. We've got a party that's so anti-science that they have to be opposed, which at the same time has got part of it right, and he's detecting a real danger, but kind of for the wrong reasons. So there's that as well. The ninth, irrationalism, well, rife in society. I've just mentioned it, really. I've just covered that. QAnon, conspiracy theories, anti-science, climate denial, anti-vaxxer, denial of the possibilities of scientific medicine. Trump himself gave us a really good example of this tendency this morning. He's been going public about his experience of being hospitalised with a COVID-19. And this is what he said. He said, "This is the real school, not the let's read the books school." So in short, what he's saying there is that he has superior knowledge of COVID now. He got the measure of it. He gets it, as he puts it himself, in virtue of having experienced it, and that there's something superior about that to the accumulated knowledge of medical science as stored in medical textbooks. In other words, if you get COVID, find somebody else who's had it and get them to treat you, rather than somebody who's up to speed with all the research in the world that's communicated through papers and books and so forth. You see this anti-intellectualism there, this anti-science tendency as embodied by the leader of the free world. This all plugs in with far-right evangelical Christianity, which is huge in the US. Trump courts that constituency. Chris Hedges called it the fascist Christian right. And they are pretty fascist. They're white supremacist. They're narrow-minded and irrational. They think that if they go to their church and get blessed with a sacred handkerchief or something like that, that they'll become immune from any viral infection. I am bathed in the blood of Jesus, one woman said. Therefore, I can't get it. I'm not wearing a mask. I won't get it because I'm bathed in the blood of Jesus. And it's a kind of total nonsense. And it's widespread. As we know, the Nazis were quite into this. And of course, it helps to divide and rule. It helps to create credulity so that when you decide to blame the left or socialists or scientists, that you've got a wide open space in which to insert your message. It's all pretty fucking horrible. Censorship by noise, irrationalism. It all goes, it's all of a piece. Of course, the other thing here, of course, is dead cats, which produces noise. You know, in the UK, we can distract from Brexit by making a lot of fuss about Syrian refugees coming across the channel in rubber dinghies. So the last one was the matter of the economy, and I'm going to present that in a separate podcast and give it a little bit of detail. So summarising, I would say that we do find fascist science in both the US and the UK, in our culture and in our politics. Some of them have been around for hundreds of years, particularly the racism. Some of them are the legacy of imperialism for the UK. And the matter of US imperialism, which is still current. The US is still the world hegemon. But as far as the manoeuvring on the ground is concerned, that we do find some parallels with what went on in Nazi Germany and in Italy in the 20s. And we should be alarmed by these things. We should be alarmed by the propaganda, and we should particularly be very careful and be ready to analyse and expose the new powers that propaganda has, which the right is managing to mobilise very effectively, given that we now have digital surveillance and data manipulation, coupled with some fairly effective behavioural science. So I think, yes, the signs are there. We already have some pre-existing fascism, some elements of fascism, and we have some signs, ongoing signs, of an incipient fascism which is developing. This stuff does need to be opposed, and very vigorously. And that will be partly a matter of the politics, of the electoral politics, of the using the current political system, but it will be partly a matter of grassroots movements and positive building, community building, building alternatives and safety nets into communities, forming alliances between broadly progressive people, cooperating internationally, and so on. There's a lot of stuff going on in that vein in the world, but there's room for more. It needs to intensify, it needs to strengthen. If, as far as I can see, a major disaster is to be averted, or a set of major disasters is to be averted, not least because the fash are science deniers, and they're in deep denial about the degradation of the environment, of which climate change is only one part. And they're in deep denial about the absolutely unstable state of the world economy, given its structures and given what the politicians are doing. So, without panicking, I would say, yes, the signs are there, and we should take heed of them. Thank you for listening. Particular thanks to our few patrons that pay for the server space for doing this thing. And I look forward to delivering the rest of this series, of which there will be a couple more. And also producing the podcast that I've got ready on these big subjects of history as a contested category, science as a contested category, the whole matter of truth, propaganda, knowledge, hermeneutics. So loads of stuff, plus we'll continue with our Lao Tzu series, plus we will continue with interesting times. And I hope you'll tune in and listen. So, dabochi, wash your hands, and make knowledge great again.